The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, are there any questions? Yeah, we'll get the mic to you.
Last week you dwelled a lot on the self, and I'm wondering how many selves do you have? How many? No, actually, that's a bad question, because you'll say no self.
No. I actually won't say that. But
so, how many senses of self do you have? That way, you have to answer it.
So, personally, I have no idea. They seem to be.
Wait a second. You have two brains. You have left and right. If you separate them, they act independently. So there's at least two selves.
Well, yes, and I would say there's probably as many senses of self as there are moments in a day. The sense of self is a dynamic thing. And there are experiences, at least in my sense, there are experiences that feel very similar. Like this is the self, I mean right now, like this is the teaching Andrea, right? And it's got a kind of similar experience, you know, there's some similar arisings, familiar experiences of how my mind is, how my body is in this position. And there's a different set, perhaps, when I go visit my parents and I become the daughter. You know, some familiar senses of, the way the body is, the way I react and respond to my parents. So the senses of self, there are some patterns that are familiar that we might begin to recognize. We have these identities almost, you know, so or senses of almost being in a role. So like, you know, the identity of being a teacher, the identity of being a daughter, the identity of being a friend, or the identity of being a driver on the freeway, or the identity of being someone grocery shopping. You know, there's all these different senses of self that come up that actually we probably do have an identity in the grocery store, you know? only it may not be at the level of being aware of it. And, you know, what I've seen in this exploration, the exploration I've been encouraging over the last few weeks, is what is it that we call a sense of self? You know, what is it that we experience as a sense of self? And we do start to see just how dynamic it is. And that's why I say there's probably as many senses of self as there are moments in the day. You know, that there's so many different dynamic, changing experiences. We tend to coalesce around some of them and create identities around some of them. And the ones that we create stronger identities around are probably the ones where the avenue of exploration is the easiest. So when it really feels like, you know, sometimes it's like when there's a sense of being wronged, or a sense of I'm right, you know, that sometimes the feeling of a sense of self becomes really clear. And that's a great time to start to explore, what is it that I am calling I or me? You know, I'm right. Okay, there's a feeling of I being here. And what is that experience? What is that? And what I've seen for myself is that when I have certain familiar patterns, it's like the sense of self is pretty much a set of familiar bodily experiences and emotions and thoughts that I've experienced before, you know, so similar patterns. And that's kind of what I call self. So, it's a very profound exploration when we start looking at that and seeing actually there are almost as many senses of, I think there are as many senses of self as there are moments in a day. So infinite, you know.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, teacher of self.
How about Jan and then John?
On that topic, in becoming aware of identities that have been unconscious and for that reason seem to act autonomously.
Yes,
It begins with awareness and that observing, as you just talked about, exploring curiosity. So being able to observe and just be curious until it kind of dissipates would be great. But it seems like there's a process. I'm curious about the process. I don't know, indulging or exploring or giving that some energy to allow it to live. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? It's a little different than just watching it.
So,
and is that helpful?
Let me see if I can restate.
And if you need a specific example, I can give it. But I'm
an example would be good.
Well, this is the 3-year-old girl in my case, who I don't know, you know, what all is going on there. So I can I can observe, but she easily also possesses me. Mm-hmm. So in that...
So you have a real sense of almost being 3 years old again, that sense of landing back in that.
Oh, totally. Uh-huh, if I allow that to... Uh-huh. I have some choice usually, uh-huh, except when there's the acting out.
Yeah.
And so to make that more conscious, it seems like it can be helpful to really allow that to be fully embodied consciously, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, rather than, you know, in appropriate settings.
Right.
Rather than just watch, although that has to happen too. So that's kind of my, does that make sense?
Yeah, I'll just restate it a little bit. And so particularly around identities that are strong and less conscious, a question around, I mean, you said something like, you know, watching it until it dissipates would be nice, but that's, I guess, what you have in mind when you say just observe. And then you asked, wondered whether it would be helpful to kind of allow it more fully and... So what I'm hearing actually is there's a little bit of an idea in the mind of the witnessing is happening in order that it go away.
Probably. Yes, so, there is the wish.
So yes, and the witnessing can be a full allowing, not with the agenda to watch it until it dissipates, but with the sense of curiosity and of understanding. What is this? What is this pattern? And so the witnessing can actually be the opening to and allowing the full embodiment of it. And that witnessing provides a kind of a balance point where we can fully allow it and be present enough to not allow it to move into the acting out place. Because when we do start acting out of that, it's more of a reinforcing of that rather than an opening to understand. It's a very fine. It's that middle way the Buddha talked about. So it doesn't even have to be like watching it until it goes away. It's, you know, sometimes these very deeply ingrained patterns, you know, they're pretty persistent. So, you know, if you can open to it and get comfortable with it, get comfortable with the being with the, I like to use the words being with, as opposed to looking at, in terms of witnessing. The looking at can create a sense of separation, a sense of, okay, I'm over here looking at that three-year-old, you know, and it creates a little bit of a separation. So sometimes we can have it, and that sometimes is exactly what's needed to create a sense of balance. And sometimes we can actually have the sense of, you know, that the awareness is just right with it. It's so that's more what I'm hearing, the full allowing, the full embodying of it, that being with. So that is another form of witnessing. You call it the being with witnessing, I guess. And part of the exploration there is how to fully allow without getting caught by and like cycling back into the pattern and acting out of it. Generally, I find it is not helpful to act out of it, but to fully allow the feelings. You know, it's like being there and feeling waves pouring through the body. You know, waves of the emotions, waves of the, I mean, the three-year-old, I would assume, has some kind of temper tantrum stuff going on or, you know, needing something. And, you know, so like the feeling of that, fully opening to that, and the witnessing of that. It creates a container in which that pattern can unfold without being reinforced. And in that container, the mind can start to learn and see what the deeper sources of that pattern are. And you know, often in those kinds of situations, this I did talk about this some last week, but you know, in those kinds of situations, not last week here in the Tuesday class, but last week in the daily life practice group, and a number of you I see looking around were there for this. So often with these strong identities and strong patterns, there's something in the middle that is kind of very tender. A wish to be loved. A wish to be happy. A wish to be safe. And so in the middle of those patterns is that kind of core wish. And, you know, if our whole idea is, you know, this whole pattern is like a problem and need to get rid of it, if we're approaching it from that perspective, that core wish is a pretty fundamental part of being human. The wish to be happy, the wish to be safe. It's a very core part of being human. And those kinds of wishes just don't go away. In fact, they're wholesome. It's metta. It's the wish for our own happiness. It's the wish for our own well-being. What seems to happen with those wishes is that they get caught up or layered over or crunched down on, partly because our perspective, I mean, so we seem to have this relationship to those wishes that if we feel like they're not possible or if they're not being met in this moment, that somehow they're bad wishes or they're wrong wishes or I shouldn't have those wishes. You know, like, no, we see that life presents us with people that don't reflect us, with situations where we feel vulnerable and we aren't safe. And so we kind of have this conflict around these wishes. It's like, you know, I wish to be safe and yet I'm not safe. Or, you know, and it's a truth, actually. The vulnerability is a truth. And yet that wish is wholesome. And so there's a paradoxical, like, meeting of that truth of the vulnerability that we can open to that vulnerability and not resist it and not, like, clamp down around it's a problem because I am vulnerable. Or it's a problem because I'm not being seen. So that it's a paradox, actually. There's a little bit of a paradox. And it happens for all of us that these very core wishes get twisted or tied up because we've come upon many situations in our lives where we feel that it's not possible to be happy. It's not I can't get what I want. How can I possibly be happy? And so we kind of clamp down on those wishes, or we twist those wishes towards some demand. And so there's the kind of the core wish, and then there's the reality of things are impermanent, things are unreliable. Things are not in our control. And those kind of, you know, reality, impermanent, unreliable, out of control, kind of comes into this, our minds puts them into conflict with these wishes to be safe, to be happy, to be at ease. And that's where a lot of these identities, these struggles come from. It's like the various strategies that we've worked with in our lives to try to navigate these truths and these wishes at the same time. Paradoxically, opening fully to both the wish and the truth of the reality leads to a very deep happiness. And so it kind of like working into, like opening to the experience of being with those struggles, those identities, fully allowing them, begins to help us to see both the core wish and the core truth. You know, the core wish of may I be happy, and things are impermanent, unreliable, out of control. May I be safe? Yes, that's a core wish. And things are impermanent, unreliable, out of control. And the heart can open to both of those. And the part of our practice is seeing where it's hard to open to those, seeing where we clamp down on those wishes and where we want to ignore the truths. So and the way into that exploration is through that being with. It begins to reveal both the core wish, which when we can touch into it, actually, is very beautiful. You know, it's like, you know, seeing that, you know, watching in my own mind, watching the mind kind of flip between may I be safe and fear, you know, a pattern of fear, watching the mind in a very strong state of fear, and then seeing that fear, recognizing, okay, let me try connecting with metta, and feeling the depth of the metta, the may I be safe was a very strong, may all beings be safe. It was such a strong wish in the midst of that fear. And what I could see was that the fear was a result of, not that it was a problem that wish was present, but the relationship to the truth of out of control. You know, that there was a, it's not okay that it's out of control in this moment. And what I saw was that there was a way in which landing in that wish very fully made the heart feel so much more at ease around that truth that things were out of control. And so, you know, opening to the whole mess of our patterns begins to kind of take us back to, I mean, when I speak of, I hadn't thought of it until just now, but the core wishes are, you know, they're in the terrain of metta and compassion. And the core truths are in the terrain of wisdom. And so it's like any pattern, any place where we're in conflict with the world, any sense, strong sense of identity like that, or it's like, I'm right, this is the way it's got to be, has at its center some pathway to lead us to understand those core wishes and those core truths, compassion and wisdom. Leading us back to compassion and wisdom, opening our heart to the truth. So it's beautiful what you suggest, and the part of the wisdom, the discernment is to begin to recognize when can you fully allow it and not get caught into it. I sometimes use the phrase get taken down the rabbit hole, you know, of that identity. You know, if you feel like the being with is taking you down the rabbit hole, then it's helpful to see if you can back off, change your attention to something else, and maybe begin to get a sense of how long you might be able to meet it in that full way before it begins to become overwhelming. And, you know, have a practice of, oh, can I be with this 3-year-old fully for like a minute, and then, you know, and then honor her. Okay, you hang out here. In fact, you can sit right there with me, but I'm going to have to right now, like you do with kids sometimes. It's like, you know, you can sit here with me, but right now I have to do this thing. So, you know, I'm not going to tell you have to disappear, but, you know, I'll be here with you. And you know, kind of having that not now, but turning your attention to something else. And slowly with that kind of practice, if you do see yourself getting pulled into the rabbit hole, slowly the practice of touching in for a few moments and then going to something else gives us greater capacity to meet that pattern. So those are my thoughts on that. And John. I don't think it's on. It's on the side.
Yeah, I think you've answered my original question in your response to Jan, but I was going to ask that, I mean, is there an extent to which our sense of identity is actually a defense or a shield against things that we think are going to hurt us, and then maybe the trick is to make that shield a little more permeable so that we can sort of roll with the punches sometimes instead of creating, just living inside a shell. If our identity becomes a shell that isolates, then I guess that's a problem.
So I would say that one of the ways that a sense of self can come up is around that shielding ourselves. And certainly if that's what's happening, I mean, I think really it comes down to making it more permeable amounts to making it conscious so that it's not, when it's operating, when those patterns, those identities are operating below the level of consciousness, what we're doing is motivated out of those identities. And so if that identity is designed to shield us from things, ways we think we're not safe, it's going to be motivating us out of fear and out of aversion. And so when those identities are not consciously recognized, they're like a filter on our experience. And we're relating to the world through that filter and acting in the world through that pattern, unwittingly, in a way, reinforcing it. And when it can become conscious, the first step is really becoming conscious, making it conscious, then it begins to become more permeable, because we can, when it's more conscious, there's a possibility of there being a little more choice in the matter around how we act. So that's one way to begin to make it more permeable. And certainly I've seen that for myself. It's like when I recognize these patterns, these identities, and they become more conscious, it's sometimes like in making them more conscious, somebody actually expressed an instruction for me once. Let that identity actually, you know, get as big as it wants to. And that scared me when I first heard it. But what happened with that was actually, and she described it very well. She said, you know, it kind of like, it's like when you see that identity, it's like it's a thing. It's like right there in front of you. It's really potent. And yet when you let it get big, it's like it doesn't have any more potency. It just gets more dispersed. And so it's almost like rather than seeing through this, you know, like just using an image of a color, a dark blue filter, if that same amount of blue is spread out over a larger space, it becomes a light blue filter. And so it's kind of like it makes it more transparent in a way, that pattern, when it becomes conscious and we can allow it. So that's one of the ways. I mean, there are other ways that identities get formed. They also get formed around neediness, you know, around wanting to have pleasant things, not always wanting to protect us, but wanting to acquire, to own, to possess. So sometimes our identities have that flavor as well. In the Buddhist psychology, they have roughly, you know, they have these personality types, and the personality types are kind of based on greed, aversion, or delusion. And I would say largely for myself, I'm the aversive personality type. So many of my identities have that flavor of protect, defend, control. You know, it's like I'll walk into the room and it's like protect, defend, control. other people have more personality types of the greed or the wanting to have things, and that may be have, possess, you know, that there's more of that reaching out, and identities would be formed based on that pattern more. And the delusion type may be more confusion or... it's said that when a person who is aversive walks into a room, the first thing they notice is what they don't like. And so that's the orientation, you know. Look for the unpleasant and get rid of it. When somebody who's kind of got the greedy personality, they walk into a room and they look for what they like. It's like, oh, what can I have? And when somebody who's got the delusional personality type walks into the room and they basically don't notice things. It's like kind of like, how do I fit in here? What's going on? You know, it's not so much oriented around liking and disliking. It's more oriented around... how do I fit in? Or one teacher talked about, she's a self-confessed deluded type. I'm the self-confessed aversive type. Sharon Salzberg. And she was traveling with somebody who was an aversive type. And she said, apparently deluded types make great traveling companions. Because we'd go into a room, and my traveling companion would say, "Oh, I'll take that bed. You know, would do you care if that's the one?" And she's like, "No, I don't care." And then a little while later, she realized that the person had taken the bed by the window, you know, with the nice mosquito net without the holes in it, and she just been kind of like, "Yeah, whatever." So, you know, the deluded type tends to not notice the details, perhaps. So that we each have our own kind of favorite identities that may be flavored by these orientations. And we all have all three of these orientations. It's not like a person who has a primary aversive tendency doesn't also have the greed and the delusion. In fact, all of our tendencies are underlaid by delusion. So I think that's good. That's enough for that. Yeah. Arthur. Pass the mic over. There we go.
So we're in a terrain I've been thinking about recently. When you're very young, 2 years, 3 years old, I don't know what age exactly, lots of things are happening to you, but you don't really have language. You certainly don't have a lot of understanding. A lot of personality, well, I don't know how much, but some personality, maybe a lot, maybe just a little, is formed without language and without a clear emotional framework to put it into.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of grow up with some underlying something that forms your personality, but it's very hard to put into words what that is, because it never had a language.
Yes.
So the question about it is, you know, how do you see that? What's that like? How does it influence what happens to you later? What's the Buddhist perspective on this sort of thing?
Well, I think, I mean, this comes in a way towards a child does experience, right? It's not that there's not experience happening there. It's a very kinesthetic experience. You know, and very quickly, you know, concepts, language begin to come in, and then later words, concepts begin to come in, you know, like a child pretty quickly understands mother, father, food, wet, you know, pretty quickly understands that thing, and also quickly begins to understand the agency that's possible, that when they cry, they get some results. You know, so there's that. It's a very kinesthetic, active experience at that age. And then as we grow up, I think, you know, more and more of our relationship to the world comes through language. And yet it's not that, I mean, if you think about somebody who's, for instance, blind and deaf, like Helen Keller was, what their experience of the world is. You know, kind of thoughts that somebody like that who's blind and deaf would have, it certainly wouldn't be through as if you're talking to yourself or somebody was talking to you. It wouldn't be as if you were seeing images. It would be as if you were feeling yourself navigating the world. And so kinesthetic experience can also be a kind of thought. And that's my understanding of how, you know, children process the world is through their bodies, through kinesthetic experience. And mindfulness can meet kinesthetic experience. Almost, one of the key explorations we make is kind of dropping below language into the kinesthetic felt sense of experience and recognizing when we are putting concepts on top of experience. And so in terms of meeting patterns that are formed at that young age, part of the exploration is learning to feel comfortable meeting experience that doesn't have concepts laid to it. And this is more and more of where the practice deepens, is when we, you know, we open to experience, we feel it in the body, and we have no clue what it is. And it's just like, this, that's what I'm experiencing, this. and to begin to be comfortable, I mean, because this is a place that I think very, again, very human, that we like to have categories for things. It's a place that we gravitate towards, to have concepts for things. And when we don't have concepts for things, there can be a kind of a discomfort. And so being able to meet the discomfort of not knowing what something is one of the edges of our practice. And so we open to, like, you know, this is a great example of, you know, when patterns are formed when we're really young and we're kind of going back. I mean, some people have had trauma in the womb, you know, mom in an accident or something, and there's trauma in the womb, and that is at a very pre-verbal level. The trauma that's in the system, and so, you know, meeting that experience, there can just be sense of terror without even really knowing what it is or why it is. And so the practice is about, you know, opening, very much in the way I described a few minutes ago, opening to the experience from that being with perspective. The looking at perspective, I think, often brings more of the concept to it, perhaps. The being with is more allowing of just the mess of that and the not knowing of what it is. And the comfortable with being with the unknown is part of the how the practice unfolds, because we don't know where we're going ultimately. And our relationship with that unknown. And so it's not like we're trying to force ourselves to be with the unknown. So this is a really important point about this kind of exploration. So when you touch into something that's like, wow, I have no idea what that is, check your relationship to not knowing. Is there fear? Is there confusion? Is there, you know, it could be as much as a dread, or, you know, it could be light, more like anxiety. So what is the relationship to not knowing? Rather than trying to say, I've got to be with that thing that I don't know what it is, notice the relationship and allow that fear, that anxiety, that confusion, that discomfort to be there along with what it is that is not really clear. So do you have more to follow on with that?
Yeah, it comes to what you did. Yes,
okay.
Related to the last part of what you said, because I find myself frequently feeling things in my body, and I don't really know what they are. Actually, I label them, and it's only later that I come to realize I didn't really get it right, because I get the same feeling and I call it something else. And I, I guess the instruction, if you can call it that I'm looking for is what you just said, to just be okay with not knowing what it is.
Yes. And if you can't be okay, then recognize the relationship to it. I mean, so
what do you mean by that?
Well, so sometimes when something unfamiliar happens, like a new state of mind or a something that we don't recognize, our relationship to the unknown is one of confusion or discomfort or anxiety or dread, or even as much as terror. You know, so we can say, oh, yes, I should be okay with this, and yet sometimes we're not okay with it. And so allowing the not okayness to be there. So there's this thing that's unknown, and I'm confused. Okay, so confusion and unknown is happening. Or anxiety and unknown is happening. And, you know, sometimes we may be able to tell, oh, this is something in the body, or this is something in the mind, we might be able to make that kind of distinction. It's like body thing is happening or mind thing is happening. You know, you might be able to tease. And sometimes we can't even tease those apart. You know, sometimes it's just not even clear whether it's body or mind. And so, you know, it's like experience is happening right now. You know, if you need a label for it, you know, you can just use something broad like Dhamma. Dhamma is happening right now. Small d, Dhamma, meaning experience is happening right now. And just like, okay, yeah, you know. And sometimes as we hang out with something that's unfamiliar, it's like suddenly the light goes on. It's like, oh, that's what this is. You know, so we do get a sense of it in the just being able to witness it. That sometimes we do, and sometimes we don't. Sometimes we never have a clue what it was. And that's okay. We don't actually have to know. The relationship and how we are with it is the most important piece. And to acknowledge that relationship if it has a confused or even it can be greed, aversion, or delusion. It can be, you know, it's often aversion. It's often fear, anxiety, dread. It can be boredom. That's in the delusional side of things. It can be confusion. That's in the delusional side of things. It can be greed, wanting to know, what is this? I've got to figure this out. What is it? So it can also have a leaning in kind of feeling to it. So you're checking into the relationship when it's something that's not known. And sometimes just the acknowledgement, at least I've recognized, oh, right, something's happening and I don't know what it is. It's like, oh, that's what's going on. I don't know what it is. Okay, I can hang out with that. You know, to just be okay with not knowing. Yeah, Bill.
Well, I just want to share that this discussion seems really rich to me, and until a couple minutes ago, I felt an urge to share, but I felt I didn't have it all figured out, so I didn't want to say anything.
There you go.
Yeah, I know. And I think that's all I'm going to say for the moment.
Great. I mean, so was that uncomfortable? I mean, was it uncomfortable to feel like you didn't know, have it all figured out?
Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so hanging out with that discomfort.
It was like something I shared a bit about last week, which was walking into a room of strangers and having a very difficult time finding my place, if you will, or connecting and wanting to run away some of the time and so forth and so on, because I don't have it all figured out.
To see that pattern, that's why you might want to do that, then you might be able to start to get, okay, don't have it figured out, that's what's happening here, you know, and to have that become conscious, I would be curious what happens for you as that becomes more conscious. You know, it might be also that's conscious, don't have it figured out, and the discomfort of that is present. But again, they can just be, oh, don't have it figured out, and uncomfortable with that. That's what's happening here. So I'd be curious what happens.
Yeah, I have a lot of trepidation about truly walking into a room of a bunch of people that I don't know anything about. There will be a lot of trepidation. Don't know if I can hold on to...
To the mindfulness?
Yes, yeah. To the mindfulness at that point. But we'll see.
Are you saying that you're more willing to say that you don't know among people that you do know, and that you won't say that you don't know among people you don't know? Is that?
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay.
Let's just see if there's anybody else first. Anybody else have anything first? Okay. Oh, Will. Will has something first. And then...
Really briefly, the question that I of innate temperament. I was there for the birth of my children. Easily could, after 6 hours with both of them, could have waited 20 years and known which was which without any trouble if I never saw them. You know, one of them electrified the world and the other liquefied. And that was just, that has not changed. So there was, there is this sense of innate body chemistry.
Yeah, there's something that we come into the world with.
And it clearly has a great deal of effect on our experience of the world.
Yep.
And it would seem to be terribly hard to tease that apart.
Well, again, you know, a lot of it is you know, it's actually, it's not, you know, teasing it apart isn't as important. I mean, because, you know, it's like there's, you know, from the Buddhist perspective, from the Sutta perspective, we come into this world with eons of conditioning. You know, and a lot of that we're not going to be able to really see or tease apart. And regardless of that, regardless of whether that's something you believe or can buy into or not, it's not necessary to have a sense or understanding around the level of conditioning is very, very deep. And the Buddha talked about that kind of conditioning of, you know, the forward patterning of our personalities and things like that is in the terrain of karma. And, you know, we've only got 6 minutes, so I don't have time for karma discussion, fully karma discussion. Basically the teaching on karma is that our choices of the past influence the unfolding of our present. And, the Buddha said that the workings of karma are so vast. I mean, just even think about, like, right now. How did you get here today? You know, just if you even reflect a little bit on, like, you know, it goes back, like, years, how you got here today. You know, I got here today. I mean, it's just like, it's mind-blowing when you start to see the conditions that came together for each of you to be sitting in this room today. And the Buddha, so that's in a sense, that's part of how, that's karma unfolding, the choices that you've made that lead to the results of your life. And the Buddha said, the workings of karma are so vast that you would go mad if you tried to contemplate them. So don't try to do that. So the teasing it all apart is not so important, but the understanding of what's happening in this moment to create the arising of the conditions in this moment, that we can touch into, especially around how suffering is created. You know, the patterns of contraction, the patterns of confusion, the patterns of wanting things to be other than they are. You know, we can see into how we're gripping, and the Buddha just pointed right to it. It's like, when things are pleasant, we want to hold on to them. We want to keep them. When things are unpleasant, we want to get rid of them. When things are neutral, we're kind of not checked into them. And that point of relationship to the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and the intentions around wanting to have more of this, get rid of that, that's how the future of our lives unfolds in this very moment. And, I'm trying to just summarize this in a way that makes sense. So I'll give an example. Maybe this will kind of make it more real. Sometimes talking in the concepts of karma, you know, it's confusing, the concepts, but, you know, so in my own experience, like, at one point I saw a particular pattern, a particular identity related to that aversive personality, and the pattern was self-hatred. And seeing the pattern on one particular retreat, one particular three-month course, the pattern was really up and willing to be seen over and over and over again. And I saw so much about it. It was mind-blowing. And at one point, it was like I kind of saw almost like hints of the reverberations back through my entire life of why this pattern was happening in the present moment. And it was like, just like you were saying, it's like it's so deep and so vast. I thought, you know, I'm going to have to be fully enlightened for this pattern to go away. There's too many tendrils. You know, it's how do I undo all of those hooks from all of those various situations that contributed to this happening now? So there's a little bit of that despair of like, okay. And to some extent, it was kind of like, okay, well, this one's going to be with me. This one's going to be with me. So I guess I really need to watch it and get to know it. And what happened on that retreat some weeks later, actually, was that watching the pattern of self-hatred arise in the moment, watching it just at one point one evening, I really had the commitment to just be right with it. It's like, there it is again. What's happening? Just seeing it happening in the moment, the arising of that pattern happening in the moment. The mind in one moment, in one split second, understood that what was happening in the moment was that a thought was arising and it was being believed. You're no good is arising and it's being believed. And then the mind recognized this is just a thought. And that undercut the believing. And that recognition in the moment, in the moment, what happened is the mind saw that, so I went from like self-hatred, seeing that it was just a thought, and then bliss. And then the mind in that bliss is like, oh, never again. And then there was more reality that kicked in, you know. No, this is just this moment. You know, this is just this moment of understanding. And yet that insight of seeing thought being believed around that particular pattern had a very powerful impact on that pattern in my mind. It was as if the rut of self-hatred in my mind went from this, from deep, to just a little valley. In one split second of seeing clearly how it happened in the moment. And so that's the power of this practice. We don't have to unhook all of the stuff. There's the seeing, the clear seeing of how it's being created right now is where the freedom lies. Use the mic. and then we have to stop because it's time.
Luck favors the prepared mind. Obviously, this happened on a retreat. You'd been working on the problem,
yes.
Getting yourself to the point where you could have that experience.
Yes.
And it's sort of like, all these tomatoes just showed up out in the yard. Huh, how'd that happen?
And I've had very profound insights in daily life as well. So it's not limited to the possibility on retreat. It does require the conditions of being attentive, of being willing to explore over and over again in daily life our patterns. And very, very powerful insights can happen in daily life as well.
Thank you. That's what I was noticing.
And we need to stop, so thank you.